This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Today is the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The attacks on September 11th brought back memories of December 7th, 1941. Now, the United States and Japan are allies, not enemies. But the lasting effects of World War II still linger. This hour, we'll look at 2 days of infamy and their echoes in history. But first, a conversation with former President Jimmy Carter. I spoke with him just moments ago about his new book, Christmas in Plains. I asked him how he's drawing on memories and traditions in this time of national crisis.
Well, it's not only memories from Plains with traditions, but it also brings me back to 1979, when the country was equally traumatized, I think, by the holding of our hostages overseas.
Mm-hmm.
We had
in Iran.
We have between 50 and 60 hostages being held. We didn't know from one day to another if they were being tortured or if they would ever come out safe and alive. And I think you may remember that almost every tree and light pole in America had a yellow ribbon on it.
Mm-hmm.
So part of my book describes the four Christmases that I was president. A part of the book describes, as you said, in my early days when I was growing up in Depression years and all my playmates were black kids. Part of it is one Christmas I asked Rosen to marry me, and she turned me down, which was a sad Christmas for me. And then Christmas, we had been married and we were on the way to having a family of our own. So there have been different times in my life when circumstances changed, but the thrust of the book is that we have to accommodate those changing times but still cling to things that never change, including Christmas with its prayers for peace and hope. And expressions of love and caring for each other.
Mm. Jimmy Carter, you were president in a thoroughly modern space-age time of computers and jets and nuclear threats, but many of the details from your childhood Christmases sound incredibly antique, wonderfully antique today. Which elements most strike you as belonging to a vanished time, and what lasts?
Well, of course, what lasts is a basic sentiment of Christmas. For Christians, obviously, it's the birth of Christ and what his life meant to the world. For Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and atheists and others, it would mean something about a season when we could get together and express love for one another and pray maybe for peace. But in those ancient days when I was a boy in a segregated society on a farm in Plains, there was an almost complete lack of material hopes at Christmas. You know, the average gift from Santa Claus, for instance, would not be electronic toys and things of that kind, but would be maybe two pieces of fruit and possibly a book, which is what I ordinarily wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So the expectations were very modest, and I think there was a lot more emphasis then on the religious and the family of, relationship with Christmas rather than the material things. What are we going to get? What are we going to give each other that really cost a lot of money?
You write about living very closely, very intimately with black neighbors and employees of your father and other black fellow residents of Plains and your small crossroads outside Plains. Do you think Americans have that kind of cross-racial line intimacy at the holidays today?
No, the America that I know today is a lot more segregated in that respect than it was when I was growing up. I didn't have any white neighbors. All my playmates were black kids. And we fought with each other, wrestled, went fishing together, worked in the field together, made toys together. When my mother and father were away for a night, I slept in the home of a black family on a pallet in the corner. Those kind of intimate relationships with the people of a different race or culture now, I think in some ways, sadly, are pretty much missing in America. But it was a surprising recollection for people that read my books to know that this kind of thing did exist, particularly in the South, when racial segregation, legal segregation prevailed, but the integration of families and playmates was almost complete.
Mm. Jimmy Carter, the country was stunned and wounded by September 11th. Behind the dark cloud of that day, do you see any silver linings? How are we doing as a people in our response? What do we need to watch out for?
Well, I think, as was the case with hostages a little more than 20 years ago, I think the devastating blow to our country experienced on September 11th has brought our nation into a much more unified state. I think we see that we all share a common grief about the losses. I think we share a common commitment not to let this affect our lives adversely. I think we share a common commitment to guard ourselves against further acts of terrorism, to punish those guilty. I think the same kind of reaction that applied not only in the hostage case, but also, you know, as you know, almost exactly the day when Pearl Harbor was attacked.
60 years ago.
So it has brought us together, and I think let us see once more, as I wrote about in the book, there are things that never change that are always important. And we need to recollect and cherish those things, particularly in moments of concern or despair or grief.
Do you see parallels between the Pearl Harbor Day and September 11th in the magnitude of the shock or in the country's response?
Yes, I think so. Of course, it was much more a serious challenge when we faced a 4 years of horrible warfare.
With Japan.
Back 60 years ago. But this time, it was much more dramatic, much more instantaneous, and the advent of television let every American almost that existed see directly the devastation of that attack, and it was brought much more personally to us than just the radio accounts of what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
And this time, how do you think we're doing with the balance of toughness in the world and openness to paths to peace?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. We obviously have full support and are being very effective in eliminating the Taliban as a domineering political force in Afghanistan. It's been surprising how little resistance they have put up in the face of American bombing.
Mm-hmm.
I've been encouraged by what's happened at Bonn. There is at least an interim government there that seems to be peaceful in nature and basically accommodating one another. I think the permanent effect of our efforts in Afghanistan will depend quite heavily on how generous the United States and the rest of the world will be in rebuilding an Afghanistan that's almost totally destroyed, both by our bombing and also by the earlier invasion of the Soviets, which, by the way, took place on Christmas of 1979 when I was in office. So these historical events seem to have a secular or cycle effect, but I think that I hope that we will be much more generous to Afghanistan when there is stability and peace there than we were when the Soviets finally withdrew.
Speaking of cycles, in some degree, the focus seems to be shifting in recent days from Afghanistan to the Middle East and Israel, a region you worked so hard in for peace. You know the players there, particularly Mr. Arafat. Do you think he's trying to rein in Hamas and the PLO and the Palestinian Authority to get them in line? What advice would you give Chairman Arafat now?
Well, even if Arafat is trying, I know from personal experience in the West Bank and Gaza dealing with the Palestinian community that he has very little actual control over Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how hard he tries, they can tell him, in effect, you know, get lost. And I think we exaggerate how much authority he has. The so-called Palestinian Authority is really a kind of a non-entity. But my hope is that we can see another era of peace. I dealt with two people, one, President Sadat, who had tried for 20 years to destroy Israel. On the other hand, Menachem Begin, who was known as a terrorist all over the Western world because he had deliberately set off a bomb in King David Hotel that killed 96 innocent people. Both of those men changed their attitude and policy in order to seek peace in a very courageous and enlightened way. And so it's not an impossibility, and I think our prayers need to still be very vital in hoping for and expecting that someday we'll see two other leaders like Begin and Sadat come forward.
Jimmy Carter, it's been a very difficult season, shocking and disturbing at many levels. As we head into this holiday season, are you hopeful for the world? Does peace have a chance?
Well, I think so. That's one of the main thrusts of the little book, Christmas in Plains, is that we shouldn't give up on the things that bind us together, the things that are really important in our lives, despite setbacks and sorrows and disappointments and fears and anguish, that we should remember the finest things in life that are encapsulated, I would say, by two words that seem to be idealistic but are really vital for a human being. One is peace, and the other one is love. And I hope it, in the Christmas season and in the rest of our lives, those two words can come forefront.
Former President Jimmy Carter's new book is Christmas in Plains. He spoke to us from Seattle. Today, as we remember Pearl Harbor, we're in the midst of a different kind of war. Last month, Japan sent out intelligence-gathering ships to aid the U.S. effort in the war on terror, and Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi pledged his full cooperation. What changed on December 7th, 1941, and again this year on September 11th? Can you picture America's Middle Eastern enemies someday becoming the kind of ally that Japan is today? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Stephen Vogel. He's a political science professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He's editor of the forthcoming book, U.S.-Japan Relations in a Changing World. Hello, Stephen Vogel.
Hi.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, well, it's great to be here.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Bedia, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Stephen Vogel, I know you've been studying for Japan for a long time. I remember you years ago coming in through immigration with me in the old days.
Yeah.
And we've watched it since, and you've heard all the talk today and in this week about Pearl Harbor and 9/11. And I'd like to just jump in with your thoughts just off the top about the comparison between these 2 days. Compare and contrast for us. How useful a parallel do you think one is for the other?
Well, at a superficial level, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, obviously, you have the element of surprise. You have the fact that you had this shocking event that kind of wakened America from its complacency prior to the attack. You also have the parallel that it's an attack on U.S. soil, which is something that has actually been very rare in recent American history. And you have attacks that really started or began a fairly abrupt shift in the nature of American foreign policy. So in that way, you have some real similarities, but I think there's also some very major differences. I mean, you've got a very different enemy comparing Japan and Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and you have a very different challenge in terms of fighting an entire country and its weapons and trying to fight with a terrorist network. And of course, the international context is quite different.
Entirely. And as you say, it's a terrorist network, not a nation. And still, we have the outline of the abrupt, shocking attack and a tough U.S. response. We don't know how useful this parallel will be looking forward either. But talk with us for a second about all these years later, 60 years after Pearl Harbor today. How does Pearl Harbor and defeat in World War II still reverberate in Japan and in U.S.-Japan relations?
Well, I think that the legacy of the Second World War is still very much a part of Japan's everyday reality, and particularly its foreign relations. I think that there's a widespread perception among all countries except perhaps Japan that Japan has not responded the same way that Germany did in terms of acknowledging its responsibility for the Second World War and paying sufficient compensation. So in that sense, there's a lot of wounds that haven't been healed, and this affects certainly Japan's relations with its Asian neighbors, but also with the United States. We have, even today, we have prisoners of war who were prisoners of war at the hands of the Japanese American citizens who were demanding compensation from Japanese corporations. And so in that sense, it's a cloud that continues to hang over Japan's foreign relations.
Jack Beatty, how about for you, the comparison between Pearl Harbor Day and September 11?
Well, what I'm struck with just is the obvious thing. These were both threats from the air and they from plane. They're very much
out of
the
blue.
Morning, out of the blue, and both in the morning, both at a sort of coffee time. You know, the one that I think at 7:56 in the morning, and the other one I think at 8:43. Breakfast in America, broken.
We're talking about 2 days of infamy this evening with Professor Stephen Vogel, University of California at Berkeley. You can join the conversation. How close a parallel do you see between Pearl Harbor Day and September 11th? And can you picture America's Middle East enemies becoming the kind of ally that Japan is today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about 2 days of infamy and the lessons we can draw from them, especially looking back to Pearl Harbor and the aftermath of World War II, U.S. relations with Japan, and whether or not that can shed any light on where we may be going with Afghanistan, with Al-Qaeda, with Osama bin Laden. We're joined from California by Professor Stephen Vogel at the University of California, Berkeley. He's editor of the forthcoming book, U.S.-Japan Relations in a Changing World. Stephen Vogel, there's a lot of talk about a Marshall plan for Afghanistan to follow what is now, I guess, the defeat of the Taliban. Of course, the Marshall Plan was focused on Europe, but the U.S. was very engaged with Japan after World War II. There might be some useful contrasts here. I fear people may expect the same kind of blossoming in stony Afghanistan that we saw in Europe and Japan, but of course, those were great industrial societies before the war. Talk to us about what happened after the war in terms of U.S. helping the rebuilding.
Well, the U.S. was actually quite generous, and I think the generosity began with the terms of the peace. The San Francisco Peace Treaty that was signed in 1951 absolved Japan of responsibility for quite a bit of compensation that it might. The war reparations were mm-hmm. very modest, mm-hmm. And the U.S. really emphasized rebuilding Japan. And obviously, I think that the Cold War context was very much part of that, the idea that Japan should be kind of a bulwark against communism in Asia. But having said that, I think the U.S. was very, very generous. The occupation was not very repressive. There was a real effort to democratize Japan, to introduce reforms that would help Japan and not just help the United States. And I think the Japanese were very grateful for that, and that was one of the reasons why, basically, by and large, we've had a very positive relationship over the past 50 years.
So now look at the United States today and its attitudes and outlook, and look at Afghanistan. Can you see a repeat of what you saw with the U.S. and Japan after World War II?
Well, as you alluded to, obviously there's huge disparities between what Japan was like at that time and what Afghanistan is like today. But I think there are similar lessons that we can bring from the Japanese case. I mean, obviously, I think that the United States does have to be generous in its approach to Afghanistan, and I think it has to have a very broad perspective on what it means to rebuild a devastated country. It's not simply a matter of securing peace and offering money, although both of those are obviously very important. But there's a much more broader agenda in terms of building institutions, and the U.S. should do whatever it can to support that process.
Stephen Vogel, I want to look with you at one of the more ironic potential outcomes of the global war on terror that President Bush has declared. Japan has recently taken further steps to kind of liberalize its policy on the military, to allow a more active military presence in the world, seeming to further break away from Article 9 of the post-war constitution, the peace constitution, if you will, that said the Japanese people would forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. That seems more and more a token now, and maybe even under cover of the war on terror, Japan is moving away from the very constraints that the United States imposed after Pearl Harbor and World War II.
I think that's right. I think Japan began to move away from those constraints almost as the ink began to be dry on the Article 9. Certainly after the Korean War, the United States started to encourage Japan to increase its own military capabilities, and the Japanese became more interested in doing so. But given that the article existed, that was done not in the context of abolishing Article 9, but of constantly reinterpreting it to allow slightly greater capabilities, with a kind of an ongoing debate between the doves and the hawks within Japan about how far Japan should be able to go according to the latest, perhaps somewhat convoluted interpretation of the Constitution. That debate continues today, but what's interesting about recent developments is that there's been a breakthrough in the sense that you've seen more than an incremental change in Japan's security posture since September 11th. The Japanese have been very forthcoming and have really stretched the limits of more recent interpretations of the Constitution.
So one day of infamy could end up undoing the constitutional constraints that were brought about by an earlier day 60 years ago.
Well, I'm not sure whether I'd go quite that far. I mean, I think there's still some very formidable constraints on Japan's military expansion. One is, of course, domestic public opinion. Another is Japan's neighbors, and particularly Korea and China, that both look very warily on any kind of expansion from Japan. But as you mentioned, in a sense, the response to 9-1-1 has given Japan a little bit of cover so that it can expand those constraints where its own domestic opponents and the Koreans and the Chinese can't really scream too loudly.
They can't say much right now with the United States calling for everyone to pitch in. And it's not a small military. I don't know the current figures, but as long ago as 1990, I think Japan ranked third behind the then Soviet Union and U.S. in total defense expenditures. These are big numbers.
That's right. It's for a country whose constitution says that it shouldn't have any military forces at all, it has a formidable military presence.
Jack Beatty, how about that long ripple of history that events in Afghanistan 60 years after Pearl Harbor may be helping untie the very constitution that the U.S. brought to Japan after a very hard war to push back for Pearl Harbor?
Well, it is quite an irony, isn't it, that that history can these currents can just go forward in this way. I'm interested in asking Professor Vogel about the way that in Japanese memory, I'm just curious, has it been the case that Hiroshima and Nagasaki have sort of effaced any feeling of culpability among the Japanese for the militarism of the 30s, for Nanking, for Pearl Harbor, and that in Japanese imagination, the Pearl Harbor is a very faint presence, whereas Hiroshima and its status as moral victim is that still strong?
Well, no, I don't think so. In the following sense, I would say that the Japanese themselves are very much divided on this issue. I would say that there's a silent or less vocal majority that very much feels that Japan should feel remorse for its actions in the sense that it was the aggressor, and that Japan needs to atone for that legacy. Unfortunately, there's also a vocal minority that believes that, in a sense, Japan was more the victim than the aggressor in the Second World War, that not simply a matter of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also the economic sanctions, that, in a sense, Japan was forced to go into war. And so you have this kind of pull and tug in within Japan. But, of course, this creates huge problems for Japanese foreign policy because every time the foreign ministry tries to come out with some sort of recognition or apology of Japan's past war crimes, all it takes is one politician saying that the Nanjing massacre didn't happen, and the whole message gets lost.
Stephen Vogel, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to ask into our conversation now, or invite in, Herbert Bix. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. He's a professor of history at the State University of New York at Binghamton. Good evening, Herbert Bix.
Good evening.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted.
Please cast your eye, if you would, on the comparison between these two days of infamy, if you will. What comes to mind for you more, the similarities or the differences?
Well, both. But the differences first, because while all analogies break down, and this one breaks down rather quickly in my eyes, Pearl Harbor was an attack on a military target, a naval base, and some civilians got caught up in it, but it was primarily intended to destroy military targets, and it was units of Japan's armed forces. That
much more conventional, traditional attack
indeed,
in that sense.
Indeed. And 9/11 terrorist attacks were perpetrated by, criminal gang, radical, Islamic fundamentalists. That having been said, I was struck by the fact that in 1941, few Japanese and few Americans understood the dynamics of the tense situation that led Japan and the United States to war. On 9/11, Americans were stunned. They couldn't understand why their country was hated. And
that's a terrific point. Dig into that a little for us.
Well,
to compare the, if you will, people don't like these words, but how Japan was provoked to this, in a sense, compared with how the Al-Qaeda was provoked or incented to do what it did?
Well, in the Japanese case, when we begin considering the long-term causes of the confrontation, most historians agree that events in the 1920s and early 30s were pivotal. If I may jump a moment to Japanese divisions of view on the significance of Pearl Harbor today, we have the far right saying that our grandparents did not put their lives on the line without just cause, that justice did not adhere only on the American side. And then they begin to rattle off a litany of crimes by the United States as it expanded in the Pacific and tried to expand in Asia. And Japan stood up. And in the litany of things that are cited by people on the right, far right.
In Japan.
In Japan, you have a recycling of the wartime Japanese state's propaganda against the United States in the 1930s.
Does it have the same clash of civilizations tone that the Islamist complaint has today?
I don't think so. There was, of course, you know, Japan as the champion of the peoples of the downtrodden peoples of East Asia. There is that element, but what it amounts to, what the case made by far rightists amounts to, is a denial of both the aggressive nature of Japan's expansion in Asia in the 30s and early 40s, and at the same time, a claim that the war that Japan fought against the United States was a war that it had been enticed into, tricked into by Roosevelt and his men. And the clinching last two events in this chain of causation was the economic sanctions, the oil embargo of the beginning of the 1940s, and finally, the last message that the American Secretary of State Cordell Hull handed to the Japanese, rejecting, in effect, all of their efforts to reach either a general settlement in the Pacific or a temporary modus vivendi. So that's the far right. Now, on the left in Japan, you also have people going back to look at this chain of causes. And on the left, there's a tendency to say that, to acknowledge what the right doesn't acknowledge, that Japan's expansion
in
Asia was aggression, and to try to excavate all the facts, get at the truth of the Japanese Army's crimes in China and the Pacific, Southeast Asia.
But the left is pretty well shouted down when it comes time to publish the textbook, isn't it?
No. I won't say that at all.
All right.
I want to finish my thought here, and
please.
Which is that when the left comes to Pearl Harbor, they say it doesn't make a difference who attacked first, because Japan was an imperialist state and so too was the United States, and with possessions, with colonies in the Pacific. And so
there's
and
a
so
moral
forth.
Equivalency there.
That's right. And then, of course, when we jump to the ending of the war, and the war ended with Japan's unconditional surrender, its acceptance of the terms of the Potsdam Declaration. And there the far right will say, well, says, well, look, did America have justice on its side when it, you know, dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And the left tends to say somewhat of the same thing, but there's a tendency for both sides When I say left, I mean far left. But the, I think the best Japanese historians do acknowledge the military context in which the war came to an end and the decisions were made.
Herbert Bix, I want to invite our listeners in. I know Jack Beatty has a question for you. We're talking about 2 days of infamy and how they ripple through history. How do Pearl Harbor and World War II still echo in U.S.-Japan relations today, 60 years later? Do you worry about Japan breaking out of its peace constitution, or do you welcome it moving toward a more active military role? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, I know you have a question for Herbert Bix about David Kennedy's view on the aftermath of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, Professor Bix, in his book Freedom from Fear, David Kennedy points out how for the Roosevelt administration, the priority, even before December 7, was Germany. Germany was considered the main threat to the to U.S. security, and that Japan was any threat there was considered as a distraction. He said in that context, the question, of course, the usual canard is that Roosevelt was responsible for Pearl Harbor, but he turns that around. He says from that perspective, the question is not who was responsible for Pearl Harbor, but who should bear responsibility for failing to pursue a diplomatic settlement with Japan that would have left the United States free to apply its undivided strength against Hitler. Roosevelt's deepest failure, it might be argued, was his inattentiveness to Asian matters and his unwillingness to be seen as appeasing Japan, when in fact a little appeasement, another name for diplomacy, might have yielded rich rewards.
Jack,
how
is he suggesting that before or after Pearl Harbor?
He's saying before.
Before, of course. Okay.
Yeah.
Herbert Bix.
Okay, I appreciate your question. It's not only David Kennedy who's made some interesting observations here. Robert Shogun, in a book on FDR some years, in 1989, I think, made the point that, you know, given Roosevelt's elusiveness as a character trait, his tendency to underestimate the ability of the American people to accept unwelcome news, and Roosevelt's failure to come forward and, you know, forthrightly make the case for intervention.
We've just got a minute, Herbert Bix.
Okay, all of these things contributed to failures on the American side. So to sum it all up, yes, there were failures of misperception on the American side. There was a racist prism through which American policymakers evaluated events in Japan, and there was an aroused American public that probably would not have tolerated much that in the way of yielding, compromising with Japan. But here's where statesmanship, greater statesmanship, might have played a role.
Herbert Bix, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Herbert Bix is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. We're talking about 2 days of infamy, Pearl Harbor Day and 9/11. How close a parallel do you see between December 7th, 1941, and September 11th, 2001? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about 2 days of infamy. We're joined by Professor Stephen Vogel, political science professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Stephen Vogel, I should have asked Herbert Bix this. He wrote the book. But talk to us about Hirohito and Osama bin Laden, and I guess in a larger sense about the otherness of Japan and the al-Qaeda. In both cases, these attacks came from societies and cultures that many Americans were not intimately familiar with, which made it easy to characterize them in a very other category. Who looked more villainous, Hirohito or bin Laden?
Oh, I think bin Laden probably wins that battle. They were certainly both villainized at the time. Mm-hmm. But Hirohito, I guess they have the similarity of both being, at least as far as I've heard, both rather soft-spoken, seemingly rather kind of quiet and pensive personalities.
What we've seen of each and saw of Emperor Hirohito, yeah.
Yes, right. but obviously, at least in the case of bin Laden, capable of extraordinary crimes. In the case of Hirohito, of course, there's questions about what the balance was between his role, but Professor Bix's contribution, of course, has been to show that he was certainly more than a passive onlooker, that he was very much involved in the planning and the execution of the war effort.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, can you picture America's Mideast enemies becoming the kind of ally that Japan is today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jan is on the line. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
That's great. That's exactly the point that I want to come back to. When you look at history, throughout history, our enemies have ultimately become our allies, and they've done so really through, you know, building relationships through business and through trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the author of a book called Collaborative Communities, Partnering for Profit in the Networked Economy, and we see tremendous parallels between what's going on in war and what's going on in business. So I think that...
How are the internet connections in Mazar-e Sharif, Jen?
Oh, well, you know, I don't think there are too many of those right now, but yet there's still enterprise that goes on. And, you know, as we work, you know, it really needs to happen from the standpoint of building trade, building business relationships, and we will ultimately turn our enemies into our business allies.
Steve Vogel, let me put Jan's question to you, or her comment. Do you see, and I know Japan's your specialty, not Afghanistan, but when you look at the two, do we have as many fibers to grab onto here to build the kind of commercial and cultural relationships that Jan describes?
Well, certainly not. Certainly not any time in the foreseeable future. Even in the Japanese case, I think that while it's certainly true that commerce and trade has been a very important part of the relationship in recent years, I think that the friendship began before that was very important. So in a sense, at the early stages, it's not so much the economic relationship. It's taking the right steps in order to open diplomatic relations to support recovery. In that sense, I think we did a lot of the right things in the case of Japan right after the war, and that's probably what's most important in the case of Afghanistan rather than trying to think about economic relations.
The next big test. Jack Beatty, I know you've been looking at how one American author, Joan Didion, processed the meaning of Pearl Harbor. Share that with us.
Yes, the Saturday Evening Post sent her there in 1966 on the 25th anniversary, and she took a pink boat out from Honolulu to Pearl Harbor, and the tour guide was talking, but no one much was listening. She says, "It is, after all, a familiar story that we have come to hear, familiar even to the children, for, of course, they have seen John Wayne and John Garfield at Pearl Harbor, have spent countless rainy afternoons watching Kirk Douglas and Spencer Tracy and Van Johnson wonder out loud why Hickam does not answer this morning. Sugarcane now blows where the Nevada went aground. An idle figure practices putting on Ford Island. The concessionaire breaks out more papaya juice. It's hard to remember what we came to remember. And then something happens. I took that bright pink boat to Pearl Harbor on two afternoons, but I still do not know what I went to find out, which is how other people respond a quarter of a century later. I do not know because there is a point at which I began to cry and to notice no one else. I began to cry at the place where the Utah lies in 50 feet of water, water neither turquoise nor bright blue here, but the gray of harbor waters everywhere, and I did not stop until after the pink boat had left the Arizona, or what is visible of the Arizona, the rusted after-gun turret breaking the gray water, the flag at full mast because the Navy considers the Arizona still in commission, a full crew aboard, 1,102 men from 49 states. All I know about how other people respond is what I am told, that everyone is quiet at the Arizona."
A lovely section from Joan Didion. Steve Vogel, I've stood on Iwo Jima, where American troops, of course, had a terrific fight with Japanese troops, and watched veterans there, I guess it was 40 years after, meet again on those beaches and hug. This time it's terrorists and not conventional forces. And can you ever imagine how can we us coming to that point of breaking through to friendship on the other side of this new conflict?
Well, I don't think we ever will with the terrorists, obviously, because many of them will be dead, and the ones that aren't dead are certainly not going to, and that aren't imprisoned, will not be celebrating the fact that they were once terrorists. Mm. So in that sense, the friendships that we're going to build in the future will not be with the terrorist organizations, but with these the country, the nation states, such as Afghanistan or Pakistan or Syria or whatever.
But also a new and interesting distinction, that kind of traditional honor of fighting men and making up after wars, even after our own civil war, won't be available to some of the combatants this time.
That's right. At the 10-year anniversary of the Afghanistan battle, the United States will show up, but the al-Qaeda side of the reunion won't be there.
Jack Beatty, isn't that that is, as George Bush says, a new kind of war with, I guess, a new kind of tale to follow?
Yes. Japan and the United States had a collision of interests. The terrorists, it's about something else. It's about something more fundamental and existential. They want us dead, and now we want them dead. It's not susceptible to any kind of, post-war reconciliation. But the larger point that we have, that the whole Arab world needs more attention from the United States, that the Arab need for democracy is there, that our backing of these regimes is costing us friends there. All these things remain true. And insofar as you can say that that's the sort of background noise of terrorism, we have a lot to do in the future there.
Stephen Vogel, look forward with us for a minute in the minute and a half we have left at U.S.-Japan relations. After all the work that's been done in the 60 years since Pearl Harbor, do you see this on a long-term, healthy footing? Is there a possibility of returning to conflict in this relationship?
Well, in terms of obviously the past 20 years have been characterized by conflict, not so much about security issues, but about economic issues. Mm-hmm. On that front, I see I'm quite optimistic because I think that the trade war era is really over, that Japan is not going to be seen as this horrible economic threat to the United States anytime in the future. And that we've also got international organizations that are going to be taking up a lot of the trade agenda in the future. So in that sense, I see a pretty rosy picture on the economic side. I'm not sure that the Japanese economy, when it's going to recover, mm-hmm. but in the sense of U.S.-Japan relations, more specifically, I think I see a rosy future. On the security side, I see the potential for some real tension. Because we set a framework for this relationship really at the end of the war with the San Francisco Treaty in 1951. Mm-hmm. And that framework has really lasted for 50 years. And there's some real tension in that. There's a real imbalance in the nature of the relationship with the United States protecting Japan, but Japan not protecting the United States, with the United States having bases in Japan. And I think that the imbalances in the relationship are going to have to be resolved or at least partially balanced out, and that process could certainly be contentious and there could be a lot of tension between the two as they shift to a more equal partnership.
Stephen Vogel, we're out of time, but we very much appreciate your time with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Vogel is political science professor at University of California, Berkeley. He's editor of the forthcoming book, U.S.-Japan Relations in a Changing World. And It's all good. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. While the attack on Pearl Harbor triggered a series of events that changed the histories of nations, it also changed personal histories and altered the trajectories of millions of lives. Tonight we have a radio diary from Father Robert Durkee, a retired brigadier general who served as a Navy gunner during the latter part of World War II and was later a chaplain in the Air Force and Army Reserves. Father Durkee talks of how a radio broadcast opened the door to a life of serving others.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
I was sitting in our living room in Belmont, Massachusetts, around the radio, and our family listened intently, particularly my father. My father was a veteran of the First World War, had been in combat. From my earliest time as a child, I remember going down cellar and seeing a German helmet that had been blown apart and a gas mask. Yet my father really never talked about the war. I knew that he was very, very apprehensive about what this would mean in our family and for his son. As a teenager, it was not that frightening for me. It meant that it would change my life, as it would mean for most every young man that could enter the military, but it wasn't an awareness that this was going to involve our lives in a way that would take us overseas and many men would not be coming home again. Our ambition was as soon as we could enlist and get into uniform and get into the war. When I went into the Navy cadet program in early 1944, I was sent to Great Lakes Naval Training Station and began my training for life aboard ship and taking gunnery practice to be the gunner on a 20-millimeter gun, and picked up the ship that we were to go overseas on, and this small ship with 1,100 tons of ammunition set sail for the Panama Canal and then across the Pacific Ocean. The invasion of Okinawa began on April Fool's Day in 1945. Every evening we were at our guns to stand up general quarters. On one occasion, as we were at our guns strapped in, a kamikaze lofted above our starboard bow and then hit not too far distant from our ship. As it hit, there was a great explosion, and we learned within hours that 40 men and a naval chaplain were killed in that one kamikaze strike. The priest who was the chaplain was Father Coble. A few days following that experience, I contracted some kind of an infection, and my fever rose very quickly, and I was sent by small boat to a neighboring hospital ship where I spent 2 weeks. During that time, I was delirious for 3 or 4 days, but I remember a chaplain that came in to visit me there. I voiced to him the experience that I had when I heard the news of Father Coble's death, that somehow if I returned home again, that I felt called to take his place and to prepare myself to become a priest and a military chaplain. And yet I buried that so deeply within me that when I did return home, I shared it with no one, including my own parents. And yet it was there through many years of wandering around Europe and going through college and eventually announcing that I would go to seminary. So for the 8 or 9 years of preparation, I more and more began to understand that this was a calling that was given to me by God, and that my life was somehow directed to becoming a chaplain to take the place of Father Coble. And so I began as an Air Force chaplain. After a number of years serving as an active duty chaplain, having married and my daughter born in France, I returned home and accepted a civilian parish, but again I began work as a military chaplain by serving in the Army Reserve. On Pearl Harbor Day, as I look back over a lifetime of service as a priest and as a military chaplain, I feel grateful for all that has been given to me, to my family, to my community, to my nation, and I'm grateful to Almighty God for allowing me a lifetime of service to fulfill the commitment given to me as a gift many decades ago.
Retired Brigadier General Father Robert Durkee lives in Nashua, New Hampshire. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for Radio Diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is WBUR.